So, just before we begin, I'm going to say one. Oh, I want to say two things, actually. First of all, I want to thank Gail B for your wonderful index of my workbook, which I pulled out today to find some things that I'm going to use for my teaching tomorrow. Tomorrow, I'm teaching a half day for Vermont Insight Meditation. It's on my website. You have to go into the schedule page, and I'm hoping you can still register for it, or you can just show up beforehand. It's from East West Coast, 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. So thank you, Gail. That really came in handy for finding some topics. And so if anybody has my work, my daily reflections, I don't know if I said that, the daily reflections book. If you have it, there's a link on my website to the index that Gail created. And you can then, if there's a particular topic you want to look up, you can look in the index. It's very thorough, to say the least, really incredible what you did. I'm also going to say that I was reminded as I was making dinner and singing along with the music I was playing, I realized I was in a good mood. And I was reminded that bad moods are impermanent, which is a really important reminder for me because this winter has not been my favorite, like, haha, happy time. Just like some funky little moods. And so it was like, oh, yeah, right. That's right. I'm not always in a bad mood. So I'm feeling better right now, which is good. Good for you guys too, because I would hate to radiate my negativity. I do enough of that. So let's meditate, and we can all radiate something positive to ourselves, at least to start. So just settling into your posture, into your sitting or lying down, whatever your posture is. And just starting by feeling yourself in stillness and seeing how you're holding your body, if it's helpful to make any adjustments to it so that you can sit still and be alert and comfortable. And just feeling the body breathing in a natural way, not trying to control the breath. Just being aware of how you are breathing right now. And just having a sense of settling. Seeing if there is a feeling of calm that you can access. So we all have that capacity to be peaceful and settled. Oftentimes, our lives and our day get out of our control in some way, start to get agitated or stressed. But if we remember that there is this stillness within, sometimes we can tap into that. One of the ways to evoke that is to try to sense that you are relaxing through the whole body, a sense of releasing all tension, all holding, almost like dissolving. We particularly use the exhalations for this aspect of practice, exhaling and releasing. So that we are staying with the breath, even as we connect with this inner calming. And so in that effort, you might find some resistance, or perhaps you'll reach the limit of calm that is accessible right now. So you might just feel a kind of edge there. Like, I can't let go of that right now. That energy seems to be stuck or persistent. And so that's okay. It's just seeing what is available to you right now. We can't force our mind to behave the way we want it to. But that doesn't mean we can't incline the mind toward certain states. So there's this inclining towards peace. There may still be mental noise. But you might be able to attune to something underneath that noise, something more subtle. Just letting the noise play on like a radio in the background, while you incline the mind toward the more settled and peaceful quality within. The breath keeps us in the body, aware of the body, aware of the present moment. Can only feel the breath in the present moment. So it helps us in that regard to have something simple and non-intrusive to focus on. Breathing in and breathing out. If you find that Really very little or no amount of this inner calm seems to be accessible. Perhaps you need to turn rather to the emotional energies that are disturbing the mind. In this way, again, we're not focused so much on the thoughts themselves, but rather the underlying feelings. When there are difficult feelings, we often try to avoid them or get around them or suppress them, meditate our way through them or away from them. But those strategies don't tend to work. These kind of feelings are really calling for our attention. So it can be helpful, really, perhaps the only effective way to work with these kind of difficulties is to turn toward the feelings, open yourself to them, breathe with them, let those energies come through, feel them in the body. There may be, again, resistance or fear of feeling, but we continue to breathe with the felt experience. It's almost as if we are expanding our field of acceptance or acceptability, giving space in the heart and mind for the difficult, for the unpleasant, knowing that all feelings are impermanent, so not to be feared. They cannot capture us. Are always temporary. But if they're not acknowledged or given any attention, they just operate in the background, undermining any attempts at meditation or mindfulness. Really our own responsibility as we meditate to make choices whether we are going to incline the mind towards a peaceful state, try to develop more concentration on the breath, or whether something like the emotions are calling for more attention and turning toward that. So an important part of our practice is to develop and learn these different strategies that we can then apply when they're called for. Try to develop an intuition about what we need in a given moment. All right. So, January 27th. Sundown is getting later, which is good if you like to do things outside late in the day. So might sound like a non sequitur, but it actually means something. Anyway, we'll, welcome everybody. I'm just scrolling around to see who's here. Nice to see people. Nice to see you, Tim. It was good to hear from you, man. Yeah. We have been going through my book, A Burning Desire, Dharma God and the Path of Recovery, now for a long time. Try to take our time with these things. And we're in step five, and I was thinking about how if somebody like came to this book thinking they were going to get to go through the 12 steps, and they'd be like, okay, step two, what happened to step one? Wait, step three, and then it goes right to step five. What happened to step four? What's wrong with this guy? So to explain the logic of this book, such as it is, the second half of the book, or the back part of the book, is goes through the steps that have God or higher power in them. So step four, which says we made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves, does not mention God. However, step five does, where it says that we admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. And this is, I believe, probably the shortest chapter in the book, because it was obviously hard for me to figure out what to say, beyond a few ideas. I was reading over this today, and I was reading along going, oh, that's good. And then I was like, wait, what am I talking about? So as those who are familiar with my work, you know that's sometimes happens in the middle of chapters, that Kevin gets involved in something in his own head that's maybe, I don't know if it worked or not. So in any case, if you happen to have the book in your hand, which you don't have to, but we're on page 169, and it says self-revealing, step five. And then there's a little passage about going to confession when I was 9 years old, which I'm not going to read because it's just so weird. Confession for nine year olds is an odd thing in and of itself. For those of you who have been Catholics or who were Catholics as children, you know what I'm talking about. I wound up committing sins in my confession because I would be lying to the priest because I had to make something up. I'm in confession. I have to say something. So it's like, let me see. I did this. It's like, I didn't really do it, which that's a problem. But anyway, I'm just going to read the section after that, after the little, scene that I wrote up here. Confession is a beautiful and vital part of many religions. So it's unfortunate that it can become so ritualized that it loses its meaning, which is a reference back to what I'd written about it. Buddhist monastics have a similar ritual, which I am told has also lost a lot of its vitality. And I don't know if that's true. I will explain a little bit more what I'm talking about. I believe it's once a month, like a full moon ceremony. Maybe somebody here knows precisely, but I'm pretty sure it's monthly, at least in the Thai forest tradition, and probably in the early Buddhist tradition, that what the monks do is they recite the precepts, the monastic precepts that are called the Patimokkha. And there's 227 of them, so it probably takes a little while. And then they are supposed to, I guess the monks like state any precept that they broke that month. I should probably try to attend. I don't know if they're open to the public, but I should probably go to the monastery and try to attend this so I know what I'm talking about. But that's the basic idea, that they, you know, that they publicly admit the precept breaking, and then they make a commitment not to break it again. And if it's a fairly serious precept, they can be punished in various ways. Yeah, there's a story I could tell, but I don't know, do I want to tell it? I'll just say that I was in touch with a monk who has a habit of breaking one of the precepts and was asking me for help, which right away, you know, it's a problem. And he it meant that he like lost seniority pretty much, which, you know, isn't really good. When you're a monk, your seniority is practically the only thing you have in terms of position in the world. So that means you go to the back of the food line, I think. So anyway, but he was honest about it, you know, so he kept confessing. All right, let me go on here. For me, it was only when I took a fifth step in recovery that I actually experienced an authentic confession. This step follows the difficult and sometimes long process of writing an inventory, the fourth step. For some, the writing is the tough part, while others cringe at the admitting that happens in step five. Either way, it's challenging work. In Catholic ritual, confession is very much tied up with a belief in God, and step five tells us at the very first that we admitted to God. It's easy to understand what admitting to ourselves and admitting to another human being is, but for a Buddhist who doesn't believe there is some being with ears up there who can hear our inventory, how are we to understand this part of the process? Before I began to teach and write about God in the steps, I largely ignored this question. But as I consider it now, I have some ideas. Oh, well. It's risky to say that we are admitting to our higher selves, as some might suggest. This idea, like the idea of Buddha nature, can easily drift into solidifying a concept of self that Buddhism rejects. Rejects on lack of evidence, not on the basis of some belief system. But we can certainly say that there are different aspects to our, quote, mind stream. We are made up of many elements, some wise, some not so wise. So we could say that the wise part of ourselves is admitting to the more, that the less wise part of ourselves is admitting to the more wise part. Another way to come at this question is from the standpoint of a moral universe. When I talked about the higher power of karma, which is earlier in the book, I made the point that the universe seems to have a moral fiber woven into its structure. When we admit our wrongs to God, we are seeing clearly how our mistakes, failings, and harmful actions broke those moral rules. Seeing the contrast between our actions and the karmic guidelines the Buddha and many other spiritual masters have laid out. We see that relationship and its dissonance in a way that allows us to feel the harm we've done. We see how out of harmony with the universe we have been, how we have been standing outside the moral laws and doing them and ourselves damage. This moral framework is expressed in what we call our conscience. Our conscience is our connection to God's law. A healthy conscience knows right from wrong, and when we admit the nature of our wrongs, our conscience is what hears us. The difference between admitting to ourselves and admitting to God is that admitting to God is impersonal. We aren't the ones who define the moral guidelines. We can't bargain with or rationalize our karma. There isn't even forgiveness or lack of forgiveness. There is only what is, the stark truth and its consequences. Admitting to ourselves and another human being opens up the possibility of compassion and forgiveness. What happened, what we did, is seen as a context, in a context. A wise response and future actions, including amends and the possibility of change, are all included in this part of the step. But admitting to God, to the unfettered truth, is the starting point. Without that, we risk short-circuiting the process and trying to avoid full responsibility for our actions. We must see this truth with honesty and integrity if we are to truly move on. So, not to critique my own writing, but I'm not sure. I mean, I'm getting at something, I think. I think it's an interesting idea that to ourselves is more like a personal thing, like, yeah, I admit it. But then this sort of admitting to the moral fiber of the universe or admitting to the law of karma is more like looking at it in this more impersonal way, so that there's really nothing that can be done then about that. This is one of the things about karma. I can't reverse it. Like, we, you know, in the steps we have this process where we make amends, and you know, there's this attempt at healing, but we can never take back what we did. What we did is done, and so, you know, making amends has a function on a certain level, but it doesn't solve the karmic consequences. So the karmic consequences are just what they are. So that's kind of what I'm getting at. I hope that makes a certain amount of sense, because otherwise I think we just throw God out of the step, and I don't know why we need him, you know. But maybe it functions in that way. I do think that it's helpful as well to look at things in an impersonal way, look at our karma in an impersonal way, so that we don't turn it into a story about ourselves and something that we're bad, you know, I'm a bad person, or, you know, or if I do this step, then I'm a good person. That none of that is really, that's not what this is about. So I did make a little note here on my own copy of this book, where I wrote Hiri and Otapa in the margin, which are Pali terms, which are about this. They're about our conscience and about our social implications of harmful actions. So Hiri and Otapa refer to the external and the internal consequences of our actions, and particularly in the consequences. And so they are sometimes called the guardians. I think guardians of the universe are guardians. And there are monasteries where they have like the gateways to the monastery. I'm not sure what monastery this is, but I've read about it, that at the gateway to the monastery, there are these two pillars that are, the one says Hiri and the other says Otapa, and they're like protecting you, right? So this is another way we look at how we mitigate, and more than mitigate, that we avoid harm, is that we keep these things in mind. Right, we keep the consequences of our actions in mind, which is a very, very much a recovery point. Right, we remember, like, oh, if I take a drink, it leads to this. there's going to be consequences that I can't avoid, and again, that the consequences are both external, because I'm going to be an asshole if I get drunk. and maybe worse, you know, and internal, which is that there's going to be guilt and remorse, and I mean, particularly if you've been sober and you're trying to stay sober, but you know, more generally with unskillful, harmful behavior, even if it's not, you know, acting on an addiction, there's the external consequences in the social realm, and then there's the internal consequences. And, you know, it's interesting, like, you know, the one of the translations, which is a little archaic but really hits home, is hirianotapa, or shame and moral dread. So the shame is the internal, the conscience, like, I feel bad about what I did. And the moral dread is, oh, man, everybody saw me do that. It's always struck me as very sort of un-American version of Buddhism. Like, when people think about Buddhism in America, they don't think about, like, shame and moral dread. It's like they come to Buddhism to get away from shame, right? But it's not meant as shame where you are, you know, just inherently feel shame about yourself. It's rather that it's more like someone who is shameless, you know, certain former, you know, national leaders might come to mind, people who really don't feel bad about their unskillful actions, right? Being shameless, well, then you can put shame in a different context of from the one that we kind of use more in the psychological realm of, like, oh, you know, people who have been shamed by their parents or something, you know, or, you know, when you were, like, naked when you were 3 years old, and you, anyway, let's not go there. I hope you get the drift of what I'm getting at. So there is a value in having shame, like being ashamed of yourself when you lie in public or harm people, or, you know, you drive away from an accident, or you don't put your grocery cart back when you're done with taking it to your car. There's a wide range here we're getting into. But I do think it's interesting that, you know, there isn't in the Western Buddhism so much of an idea of this morality in Buddhism. It's like, oh, everything is relative. And it's like, no, not really, you know. So I think it's really useful. And this is one of the reasons why I love recovery as a foundation for Buddhist practice, because, you know, we are very much about living harmlessly and living morally. We don't, not only do we not get intoxicated, we don't lie, cheat, and steal, you know, and all the other things that go along with real recovery, as opposed to just being sober or not using, abstinent. So, do I want to say more about that? I think that's enough for now. I'll just open it up and see if there's any comments or questions anybody wants to make. And, you know, you can talk about step five if you want. I didn't really go in very far into that. Hello, Sean. I'm glad to see that you've uprighted yourself. You were a little sideways before, I think.
Oh, yeah. My apologies. Sorry for if I was distracted.
I was just a little like, oh, is that guy sideways, or did he turn?
Oh, yeah, I was sideways because I was trying to read the chat without flipping my tablet. But
okay. Yeah. not a problem.
Yeah, thank you very much. For this tonight. This is my first time here, and I really deeply appreciate all the work you've written, you know. But my question is not so much about what you spoke about tonight, but it's a practical question. On Tuesday afternoon, well, afternoon to noon, East Coast, Long Island, are you also going out of this book or a different book?
Oh, yeah. I am, You know, I kind of go in and out of the book depending on what's going on in my head. But yeah, this is the one book that I'm working with right now. So, but sometimes something else will kind of come up that I'll get off into. So I'm not really consistent with it. But yeah,
Okay.
we spent about the first 2 years of the pandemic doing one breath at a time. And so I'm sorry you missed out on that. That was a good 2 years, at least for some of us. And I don't know what we're going to do after this. I mean, it seems to go on and on, but I do have six books, so I figure I'll make it to, I'm not sure where I'll be. I'll have to start writing ahead to have something to. I mean, obviously, we don't have to use books. I just use my books as a
Keep
something
it going.
to set off a conversation.
Yeah. But thank you very much for your work.
Okay. Yeah, it's nice to have you here. Anybody else want to chime in? Come on, guys.
Okay.
Good.
All right.
Vicky, right on.
Yep. So, yeah,
Yay.
I'm thinking about step five, trying to do some writing about it. And the intimacy that's established in that, in doing that step, with a sponsor or a spiritual advisor in the program,
Yeah.
it seems very, very powerful to me. There's a lot of courage required. There's listening. There's a kind of a true power that's manifesting in that relationship during that step.
Yeah.
Or it can. Maybe not always, but
Right.
for me, I've experienced it. And it is mind-blowing, really. And I would call it a higher power. I would call it evidence, of what I'm thinking of as higher power. The Brahmaviharas come to mind, and that kind of moment, where things just kind of open, is what I'm trying to write about. So
Nice.
you want to help me?
I think that's great. I don't think you need my help. That sounded really good. You helped me. Because I think you're exactly right, and of course that's one of the things that 12-step literature focuses on as like that, when people get together, that's where like the spiritual juice comes from, although that's not the language of it. And of course, Sangha is one of the three jewels in Buddhism. And
Oh,
clearly,
okay, that's good.
yeah, I mean,
Yeah, right.
the Buddha talks about, how there's one talk I was listening to Ajahn Amaro where it was like he was talking about this sequence of sort of building towards awakening, and it started with community or with a wise person, so that's really vital. I mean, we get it here together. Just why do we come together just to stare at a screen? It's because of something that happens within us. You reminded me of something else that I did not write, however. That I thought I would read a little bit. It's from the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And this is about step five. I'm sure you're familiar with it. We pocket our pride and go to it, illuminating every twist of character, every dark cranny of the past. Once we have taken this step, withholding nothing, we are delighted. This is like another series of promises, right? Like this ninth step. We are delighted. We can look the world in the eye. We can be alone at perfect peace and ease. It's really interesting, right? That relieves us of, like, our fears fall from us. We begin to feel the nearness of our Creator. Uh-oh. We may have had, but this line I really like, we may have had certain spiritual beliefs, but now we begin to have a spiritual experience, right? The feeling that the drink problem has disappeared will often come strongly. We feel we are on the broad highway, capital B, capital H, walking hand in hand with the spirit of the universe. Wow, that's a pretty strong paragraph there. But it is like a whole other series of promises, like the ninth step promises. I'm not sure, you know, if you probably took some time, you could make Buddhist correlations, but just the language of it as it is pretty beautiful and powerful. You know, and I mean, it's interesting to look at what it's pointing to, that we are delighted. So there's this lightness, right? We can look the world in the eye. We can be alone at perfect peace and ease. So those are all very much about Hiri and Otapa, right? Shame and moral dread. Our fears fall from us. So, I mean, that implies that the secrets that we had, we were afraid when we were carrying them around, that there was this fear of discovery, I think, in some way, or I'm not sure what the fear is, but that's one. We begin to feel the nearness of our Creator. I mean, that's kind of what you're talking about in terms of doing that with a partner, with a sponsor. That you feel a spiritual, and then he's then explicitly saying that that's a spiritual experience. I don't know, you know, how many people here have done this. You know, my recollection of reading the fourth step to my sponsor and doing it, I mean, yeah, and doing a fifth step with him and afterwards, what it was very powerful. And it was, I mean, that's when I was actually working the steps, you know, from when I got a sponsor in the summer of 1986. And, you know, I wrote my fourth step in around probably September. So I read it to him and then started in the amends process. So, you know, in a several month period, it was all those middle core steps. And it was a big moment in my life in terms of the changes that it set in motion. Didn't seem directly related to the steps, but it's kind of like the willingness to do that, you know, to go through that, and it's just almost as much willingness as we need just to get sober, you know, just to quit. You know, it's a huge risk we take. At least, I mean, it feels like a risk. It's right. I don't think it isn't really a risk, but I think that it's also the other thing I was thinking of as you were talking was that it also requires a lot of faith on the part of right. The person reading the fourth. You've got to really trust this person to do it, you know.
Yeah, and the trust is felt quite new. It was a different kind of. It was a different kind of trust than the than the usual kind of half-assed trust. Something was going on that was, you know, new and unfamiliar and powerful. Yeah. And it did feel as if there was something else at work, you know. Yeah. Well, and Debbie, I saw, you know, was talking about the broad highway as the path.
Yeah,
that's thought, really, you know.
That's great.
Right.
I really like that too. Yeah, that's beautiful. So before I go, I'm going to see if I can pull up the, okay, yes. I told you that I had the index on my website. So I'm going to put a link to that in the chat. So if you're interested in the index to the Daily Reflections, you can get it from that link. Is the Tibetan tradition of Sogchen, is that Logja? Sogchen? I don't know. I don't know what that is. Jean, do you want to say something? I don't know what that, I'm not familiar with that.
Hi, Jean. Thank you. I'm just a beginning student of the Tibetan tradition. My understanding is Sogchen is the time when one might talk to their spiritual teacher about their shortcomings or their violations of the paramitas but I can't speak intelligently about it.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's right. I mean, it sounds right. I mean, I think all the traditions have something like this, right? All the religious traditions. They're probably very similar. Before I go, I wanted to mention, anybody who's in the Bay Area, you might enjoy coming to Spirit Rock on Sunday afternoon. There's a 2-hour event for Wes Nisker's 80th birthday, and it's going to raise some funds for his health care, which is, his health is deteriorating. And there's going to be a lot of really cool people, including yours truly. I'm supposed to play some music with Wes if he is up to it. If not, I'm going to probably do a song myself, but there's going to be, Jack Kornfield is going to be there live, of course, says Will Kabat-Zinn, Tisha Bell, the great Qigong teacher. Joseph Goldstein's going to zoom in, I think. And there's like 18 people on the list. So from 2 to 4, Sunday afternoon, this is for non-football fans, which is probably most of you. Unfortunately, it is not me, so I am letting go of football on Sunday somehow, or I'll just be watching on my phone one way or the other. So just wanted to let you guys know that. And yeah, as I said, tomorrow I'm doing half a day with... the other thing I should let you know, tomorrow is Vermont Insight, but... Again, Bay Area people, I'm going to do a book reading event on February 5th at the Ferry Building in San Francisco. And that's at 3:30 in the afternoon. That's like a week from this Sunday. And Eugene Cash, the San Francisco Insight founder, is going to be my interlocutor. I was trying to learn to say that word, interlocutor, because I think it's a cool word. Thank you, Eleanor. I hope that passed your standard. Sean, was there something you wanted to say? Or was that?
I forgot what I was going to ask. I'm sorry. The thing on Sunday, is it free?
It is not free. They're asking for money, but you can always they don't turn people away, you know.
I'm medically on a fixed income.
Yeah, I mean, if you show up and just say, oh, I'm on a fixed income, here's $1, here's $5 or something, just make a gesture, people will generally, yeah.
All right, thank you, Kevin.
Okay. All right, well, now we have hands up right at 8:01, but fine, go ahead, Flippy.
Oh, hey, Kevin, thank you for this, and good to be with you. I was thinking, should I put my hand up or not?
Yes, of course you should.
Okay, great.
I'm not in a hurry. I mean, I'm probably only going to be able to see the second half of the Warriors game anyway. So
there are promises in Codependence Anonymous, and they correspond to the step and the tradition.
In which Anonymous? In what?
Codependence Anonymous.
Oh, yeah. I've heard of that. Coda. Yeah.
So in Coda, the fifth promise, which corresponds to the fifth step in the fifth tradition, says, I know a new love and acceptance of myself and others I feel genuinely lovable, loving, and loved.
Great. Thank you. Vicky, are you listening? Vicky is well, should I say this in public? Do you want? It's okay. She is working on a book with a friend for around codependence issues and Dharma, to try to, because that's been something people have been asking for, and she and Liesl are interested in.
Wow.
And people have asked me to write that before, and I've kept saying, no, I can't, you have to. So there you go. Thanks, Flippy. That's a good quote. And John.
Hey, Kevin. Just a quick question for tomorrow. I'm signed up to attend your event.
And you might be late. That's okay.
How do you read minds now? Is that?
You know, I didn't do all this meditation to not be psychic. And also, Vermont Insight might have written to me, and I was like, oh, John, I know John.
Yeah.
No, no worries.
Okay.
I told them to just let anybody in, please, you know, whenever people arrive, and, you know, that a Zoom half day, you know. And so if anybody is interested, what I'm going to be doing tomorrow is Four Noble Truths and Recovery and the Eightfold Path and Recovery. So that's going to be like two talks, and then we'll do some sitting, and there'll be a breakout session at one point, and should be fun.
Well, it's okay to come in late?
It's fine with me, as you know.
We'll have a recovery Dharma meeting on Saturdays of my home group. I get out at about 10:30.
Yeah, I mean, what you should do is go on their website and, like, register. Okay. And then you know, once you get registered, they'll give you the link. And then, you know, then you can show up when you can show up. It sounded like they were like, well, like, I hope they're not like, oh, registration is closed or something. Like, I would not, I'm trying to tell them, like, don't worry about, like, registering. Just, you know, I mean, they might want to just control Zoom, which is always wise, as we've learned. But beyond that, you know, for people to show up a little later, a little early, that's fine, you know.
Thank you so much.
Will it be recorded? No, it will not be recorded. I'm sorry. It actually said that. I noticed that in the email they sent. Yeah. All right, guys. Nice to see everyone. Have a safe weekend. Meditate every day. And radiate loving kindness over the entire world. That's my instructions for the day.